The views and opinions expressed here are those of the guests and are not the official position of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
One of the most remarkable aspects of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright.
I'm Matt Henderson, filling in for Nathan Wright. From December 1838 to April 1839, the Prophet Joseph Smith, along with several other church leaders, was unjustly imprisoned in a rough stone dungeon measuring 14 by 14 feet, with a ceiling just over 6 feet high. Only two small barred windows allowed light and air into the cell. The six prisoners suffered from the cold winter weather, filthy conditions, hunger, and illness. While in Liberty Jail, the Prophet wrote letters to his family and the saints. His correspondence contains some of the most poignant revelation found in Scripture. Joining me in studio today are Gary Boatwright Jr., Amy Nuffer, and Melanie Hinton. Gary has worked for the Church History Department since the year 2000. His current assignment is Historic Sites Researcher, where he is involved in writing historic site guides for the missionaries that work at these sites. He received a bachelor's degree in history and geography from Weber State University and a master's degree in museum studies from the University of Oklahoma. Amy and Melanie are both interns with the Church Historic Sites Group. Amy graduated from Brigham Young University with a Bachelor of Arts degree in history. She has since worked at a museum near her hometown of Portland, Oregon, and is currently enrolled at San Jose State University in their Master of Library and Information Science program. Melanie has a master's degree in English from Brigham Young University and is currently working on a PhD in 18th century British literature from the University of Utah. She is originally from Washington, Utah. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Before we get into the subject of Liberty Jail, could you just tell the listeners what is the Historic Sites Group and what do they do?
In the Historic Sites Group, we're obviously part of the Church History Department, and we work very closely with the Missionary Department and the Physical Facilities Department. The three departments have responsibility for managing, developing, and operating the many historic sites that the church owns. And the Historic Sites Group of the Church History Department, we provide the interpretive material for the missionaries. We assist in doing the research for historic sites. We write the historic site guides, which the missionaries use to help give them the historical background of the site. And then any other questions that pop up about the history or the preservation of the site, we lend our hand there to make sure that we preserve these sites for a long, long time.
Wow. I'll bet that's a fun job. As interns, I'll bet that's been a fun job for you.
It has been. It's been an education for me. So.
Yeah, we really enjoy the work and the people we work with, and being able to find out about all the sites and everything is a lot of fun.
Liberty Jail. Joseph Smith said of Liberty Jail, he said, "We cannot get into a worse hole than this is." Would you give us a physical description of Liberty Jail, where it's located and what it, the physical description of it?
Well, today the Liberty Jail Historic Site, it's about 20 minutes northeast of downtown Kansas City. And it's just east of I-35, and the actual jail itself has long since disappeared. But in the early 60s, the church reconstructed the jail and a visitor center around it. But the jail itself at the time of Joseph, as you mentioned in your introduction, it was just about 14 feet square, had two levels. The upper level is where the jailer and his family resided, and then the lower level, which was referred to as the dungeon. And the jail kind of had a unique makeup. It was made of rough-hewn limestone walls that were 2 feet thick. And then there's a space about a foot thick. And then the interior was built of oak logs that were hewn, and they were about a foot thick. And between the gap, between the stone and the wood, they put in loose rocks so that would be another barrier that people would have to try to get through if they escaped.
I'm wondering if you tried to dig a hole through the wall, you ended up with a pile of rocks.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so basically this was a 4 foot wide barrier that anybody who had to try to escape would have to go through. Mm. And many believe that it was impossible to escape from.
Wow. So what are the events that led up to Joseph being imprisoned in Liberty Jail?
Well, it started off in the fall of 1830. Joseph Smith received a revelation that called Oliver Cowdery to go on a mission to the Lamanites. And they understood that the Native Americans were the descendants of the Lamanites. And so first three other men, and then they had a fifth man join them. But they went to Missouri to go preach to the Lamanites. And along the way, they stopped at some places and met with other Native American groups, and also in Kirtland, Ohio, which is where they met Sidney Rigdon. He had been a friend of Parley P. Pratt, who was also one of the missionaries. So when they were in Kirtland, that's where Sidney and a lot of his followers joined the church. And so that was a huge milestone in the church's history in and of itself, that happened with the Lamanite mission. But they've eventually reached Missouri and didn't spend a whole lot of time preaching to the Indians because of different legalities. They didn't have everything, the paperwork and everything that they needed. But eventually, they just settled in Independence for a few months. And then that summer, some more of the church was called to go to travel to Independence. So Joseph Smith and some of the other leaders and a branch called the Colesville branch that had traveled from New York to Ohio, they were also instructed by Revelation to go to Zion, which they weren't exactly sure where that was, but they knew it was on the borders near the Lamanites. So they all traveled to Missouri in the summer of 1831. And while they were there that summer, they received the revelation that the center place of Zion was in Independence, Missouri. And they dedicated the spot for a temple and dedicated the land for Zion. And then that kind of started the floodgates of immigration, I guess you could say.
So this is the edge of the frontier.
Yes.
It is.
Yeah, and the descriptions of what Independence was like at the time are very interesting because, yes, this was the frontier of the organized states of the United States. The Indian Territory was just on the other side of the Missouri border, and so it attracted a lot of people who were trying to escape the law because they went to Independence, and if they heard that there was a lawman nearby, mm-hmm. they could just go across the border real fast and get away from that.
Indian Territory out of his jurisdiction.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting.
A missionary who was from the American Home Missionary Society, in about 1831, he was writing letters back to report on his missionary efforts in Independence. And he called it such a godless place filled with so many profane swearers would be difficult to imagine. Christian Sabbath observance here appears to be unknown. It is a day for merchandising, drinking, gambling, and general anti-Christian conduct. Gouging and more serious forms of violence are common. The sheriff confided to me that the citizens do not care to have the lawless punished. And I thought that was a very fitting description of what Independence was like when the saints arrived there in the summer of 1831 and started to gather there and trying to establish a community. In a society like that, you can imagine how that would be very difficult and create a lot of conflict.
When it was revealed to the prophet that Independence was the center place where Zion should be established, there's this great, almost a fervor, you know, amongst mm-hmm. members of the church who wanted to go there. And many, you know, picked up their stuff, packed their bags, and went to Zion. They wanted to be a part of the building up of Zion. And as church history has shown at numerous times, when large bodies of saints tend to gather, you know, they bring with them different ideals and philosophies and understandings of life and politics, and the local people were, you know, starting to be outnumbered and started getting a little upset at it.
So did the local people there know a lot about the Mormons?
I don't think they knew hardly anything. It was such a fresh, I guess, religion, you could say. Mm-hmm. Word had spread, I think, but I think they just distrusted them because they didn't know a whole lot about them. But
so the church has only been organized 8 or 9 years at this
point. Well, at this point, we're...
Oh, when they first arrived.
Yeah, when they first arrived in 1831, it's
so
just
it's
over
just
a year
old.
Yeah.
And when he was imprisoned, it was only 8 or 9
mm-hmm.
years.
Well, and the thing, too, that caused some of the conflict was the difference between cultures. I mean, most of the saints were from New England and the northern mm-hmm. Northern states.
So they were conservative Protestants mm-hmm. and Quakers.
And so. Most of the folks who emigrated to Missouri or moved to Missouri were from the southern states, you know, slaveholding and those ideals. So you have, you know, what we see later happen in the Civil War, these two cultures fighting. We had kind of, you know, a mini version of that where these, you know, the northern culture and the southern culture were, you know, just rubbing against each other just because they're different ideals.
Yeah, and it all, I guess, erupted in the summer of 1833 is when the major events happened in Jackson County, where they had the destruction of the W.W. Phelps printing press and office, and they tarred and feathered Bishop Partridge and Charles Allen, and these other events, lots of harassment of the saints and things that eventually drove the saints into surrounding counties. Most of them went to Clay County, just across the Missouri River, but all of those things contributed to the saints eventually being forced out of Jackson County.
And they were accepted in Clay County originally.
Yes.
For a time.
Quite kind when they first came. Yeah.
The citizens of Clay County were very sympathetic to the saints and their cause. But over time, as, again, more and more saints mm-hmm. came into the county, they kindly asked them to leave.
And I can imagine they've probably seen more and more come in, and it's a little unnerving. What's going to happen? Are they going to take over?
Yeah. And when the saints first came to Clay, it was sort of understood that it would just be a temporary thing because the saints were expecting to go back to Jackson County. They were expecting to go back to the lands mm-hmm. that they had bought there mm-hmm. and everything. And so the citizens of Clay County were like, okay, you can take temporary refuge here. And so when it looked like it wasn't going to be temporary...
They started building homes.
Yeah, exactly. They said, okay, we would like you to leave. And that's when the saints started looking farther north in Missouri and found some places. At the time, it was Ray County still. They bought some land there, and that's what became Far West, was on the borders of Shoal Creek. And this was in the 1836. And in the fall of 1836, they decided to create two new counties that would enable the saints to all gather in one place and kind of have their own county that they wouldn't be bothering anyone, no one would bother them, and everyone could just live in peace. But that didn't exactly turn out exactly as they planned, because originally they just wanted to create one county for the saints. And what happened was in the land where they wanted the one county, they divided it into two counties.
That was really Caldwell and Davies
yes.
County.
Yeah. And so the saints were supposed to settle in Caldwell County, where originally they were planning to settle in the land in all the space of Caldwell and Davies County. They kind of got confined to just Caldwell County. And so kind of happened that little, as more and more saints came to Far West in Caldwell County, it kind of got pretty full. And they started settling into Davies County as well, where Adam Adayaman was. And that started creating more tensions with other people around Davies County because they said, you guys weren't supposed to settle here. But kind of the same exact pattern again that had happened in Jackson and Clay counties, where a lot of people, they just started getting scared of all of the huge numbers of saints that were there.
Hmm. Interesting. So now, was Joseph Smith, first of all, he was with other people in the jail. Do you have their names right
yeah.
off?
Right Joseph off Smith here? Was in the jail with all the members of the First Presidency. So him and his counselors, his two counselors at the time were Sidney Rigdon and Hiram Smith.
Mm-hmm.
And then in addition, Lyman White was there and Caleb Baldwin and Alexander McRae. Mm-hmm. Those were the six men who were put into Liberty Jail.
Now I'm a little confused about, had he actually been charged with something at this point when they were in Liberty Jail? Had there been a trial yet, or were they waiting trial?
There was, and let's go back just a minute to Far West. I mean, the prophet was experiencing numerous difficulties in Kirtland. And during most of the Missouri period, the prophet was in Kirtland. But with the tension and dissension that was going on there, he came to Far West. And it was almost immediately after his arrival that things really started to flare up. And eventually what had happened is the Missourians really had had enough. Governor Boggs issued his extermination order. And the Missouri militia basically laid siege to Far West. And so in negotiations, Colonel Hinkle, who was a member of the church and also leader of the Mormon militia, he was negotiating with the Missouri militia to have a peaceful settlement to this. And unknowing to the prophet, Colonel Hinkle agreed to turn over Joseph Smith and other leaders of the church. And so when he came back to the saints, he told the prophet that, I've arranged a meeting where we can negotiate the settlement of, the difficulties. But when they arrived in the Missouri camp, he basically told the Missourians, here's the prisoners as promised. And so the prophet and numerous other men were taken prisoner. And eventually they were taken to Richmond, where there was a preliminary hearing that was held. And this hearing, it was to try to find out if there was enough evidence to show that a crime had been committed. And the prosecuting attorneys, they focused their case on three points. First was the burning and plundering of homes in Davies County by the Mormons. And that was, again, with the tensions going on, there's fighting going on back and forth. The second was the Battle of Crooked River, which was a battle, literally a battle between the saints and the Missourians, mm-hmm. and there was a few saints who were killed, and I believe a Missourian.
One Missourian and three saints.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So it was a costly battle. And then the third charge was the supposed treasonous activities by the church leaders, or by the leaders of the church, I should say. And so this preliminary hearing went on for about 2.5 weeks, and numerous witnesses were called, members of the church and non-members, and some who were once loyal to the prophet had turned against him, and other members said they were forced to testify against the prophet. But eventually, at the end of the hearing, the judge determined that there was enough evidence to to hold the prophet and these other brethren in jail. But there was no jail in Richmond at the time, so they were sent to Liberty Jail for their confinement. And on December 1st, after a day of travel from Richmond, they arrived in Liberty Jail. And there was as they were brought into town, there was a number of town folk who came and, you know, to witness the Mormon prophet and these others being taken into the jail. And one of these people wrote that the prophet Joseph Smith, he was the last prisoner to leave the wagon. And he says that the prophet climbed the stairs, turned partly around with a slow and dignified movement, and looked at the multitude. Then turning away, he lifted his hat. He said in a distinct voice, "Good afternoon, gentlemen." And mm-hmm. then he entered the jail. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of in a nutshell the events that kind of led the prophet and the other brethren to be in Liberty Jail. And they were confined in jail because the charge of treason was a non-bailable offense. They couldn't post bail and, you know, await their hearing, you know, at home. They had to be confined until a court could be convened to hear the charge.
Hmm. So clearly things were not going well for the rest of the saints.
No.
while he was in prison. And I had not made that connection really in the past when I thought about Liberty Jail. I hadn't made that connection that things were not going well for the saints either. So the main concentration of the saints were in Missouri?
In Far West.
In Far West at this time. Mm-hmm. And what was life like for them? We've discussed a little bit about the wars and so on, but how many do we know how many saints approximately there would have been?
I'm an English major. I don't know much about numbers. I can tell you that life was really transitory for them at the time. So there was the extermination order kind of looming over their head that says, you've got to get out of here as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. When the militia came, so part of the agreement with Colonel Hinkle that the militia made said that the saints needed to get out of town basically as soon as possible and that they needed to give up their weapons. So the militia came into Far West, kind of took over. People in Adamondiamon, which was the other large collection of saints in Missouri, left Adamondiamon by order of the militia almost as soon as their church leaders were gone. So everybody was in Far West. Half of the people there had come from Adamondiamon and didn't have homes, so they were camping in people's lawns. Hmm. This was after they had filled up all of the house space, all of the floor space that of the homes that actually did exist. And the militia was there, and they were literally preying on the people there. The accounts that especially the women there told are really horrific of men who would just come and shoot a cow while a girl was milking it, or take all of their food, take their, you know, the corn in their fields and their chickens and things like that, and then just ransack their homes for bedding and things like that. So they had very, very little to live off of material possessions, and they were in the process of trying to move out
and
of the state.
Also, sorry to interrupt, but also at this time, I think a lot of the men had either been arrested. There were, 50-some men who had been arrested. So they were either gone in Richmond or other jails, or they had fled to avoid arrest. So that's why I think a lot of the accounts come from women, because there were a lot of women there by themselves with just their children. There were men there, of course, but a lot of them, had either been arrested or had fled to avoid arrest. And so that also added to, I think, a lot of the difficulties.
Yeah. People started moving to Illinois, almost the ones who were able, almost as soon as they could. But the saints as a body still kind of hoped that the extermination order would be rescinded and that they'd be able to stay. But it eventually became clear to them that they couldn't, and they had to leave. And Brigham Young and Heber C. Kimball were the ones that really masterminded the effort of getting the poor people across the river into Illinois, and it was a massive effort. In the process, they had to sell all of their lands, including the lands that they still held in Jackson County, and they got the saints out just in time. By the time of the deadline.
Do we know how seriously the citizens of Missouri took the extermination order?
There's a chance that by extermination, Governor Boggs meant simply they need to be run out of the state. Mm. That was another definition that was floating around at the time for the word exterminate.
It was also a military order.
So the citizens were not to do it, but it was a military action.
Yes, it was a military action that was to be enforced only basically in time of war, kind of. And so it wasn't necessarily this open-ended, feel free to shoot a Mormon if you see one. Mm-hmm. So the citizens, I'm sure, knew about it. But it was not necessarily just a free-for-all, kill anyone who looks like a Mormon and you're okay.
and certainly they didn't do that because we have accounts if they did.
Well, you find it difficult to believe that Clay County would be accepting and then within a short length of time be killing people.
Yeah, exactly.
You find that hard to believe.
I know there was one exception to that, and I think that, you know, that was the Hans Mill Massacre.
Right, but they didn't at the time know about the extermination order.
That's correct.
So that was just a band of vigilantes, basically, that just decided they were going to go take matters into their own hands, and they hadn't heard the extermination order by the time they did that.
I read that they did get visitors. Hiram Smith blessed his baby there, and Emma visited several times.
You know, the visitors they received was one of the few comforts that they had. And, you know, being in this miserable hole, I mean, it is the only way you can call it. And to have loved ones come, and frequently they were able to stay the night with them and to see their children. And Hiram, you know, his youngest son, who Joseph F. Smith, you know, the first time that he saw him was in Liberty Jail. And as you mentioned, he was able to bless him. But, you know, between family members, you know, Joseph and their wives and Don Carlos Smith, their brother, came, and also family members of the other prisoners frequently came to visit them. It brought great joy and, I think, relief, one, to see their loved ones, and two, to see them safe. Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, when they did visit, they would bring the news of the sad condition of the saints and their plight and trying to leave Missouri. And, you know, so in one hand, it was, you know, a blessing and a relief to have them with them. But on another hand, you know, the sad news that they brought with them just was heart-wrenching for the prophet and Hiram and the other brother.
Here they feel responsible for taking care of the church, and there's nothing they can do about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there literally was nothing they could do. I mean, they wrote numerous letters to give counsel and guidance.
And they sent money at least twice, I think, to the saints to try to help them. But
if you think about the whole reason why the church came to Missouri in the first place, that really kind of hits home one of the really difficult parts of being in Liberty Jail was that separation. When they had come together as a people, and now the people are scattering out of the state and their prophet isn't with them. So.
And you're on the frontier. Who knows if you're going to be able to gather everyone back together?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Very difficult situation. Some of the letters that Joseph wrote, I mentioned in the opening that they were some of the most poignant things that we have in Scripture.
Yes.
Do you have some of those?
I do.
You want to read?
I do. Some of the quotes that you've been mentioning.
Of course, the English major has the letters.
I spent a lot of time reading the letters, and I feel like I grew really close to the people who wrote them. Letters are so intimate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there are these letters that Joseph wrote to his wife, to the church. He wrote a letter to Heber C. Kimball and Brigham Young. giving them instruction about how to get the saints out of the state, and some other things he wanted them to do. There's one letter from Emma. These are letters that still exist. So there were probably other letters. In fact, we know there are other letters that were written, but these are the letters that we still have. There's one letter from Emma to Joseph. There are a series of letters from Hiram to his wife, and one letter from her back to him, and letters from other church members to the prisoners. What would you like to know about the letters?
Whatever you'd like to tell us. We'll leave that up to you.
Okay. One of the things that I think is the most interesting, I've really been taken, Amy and Gary both know this, but I've really been taken with Hiram's letters. He wrote a series of letters to his wife that he wrote them, most of them, within a one-week period. And for some reason, he became obsessed with this idea that his wife had abandoned him or deserted him. And he writes about it quite often. His first one is very, very positive. He doesn't say anything about that. And he's talking about how they're being imprisoned like the prophets of old, like Joseph of Egypt, and all is well because they will be saved for their efforts. And then things kind of quickly go downhill from there. And he talks about how, as he's writing, despite his manhood, his tears are watering the paper as he writes. And then he starts to say things like, why haven't you written me? If you've deserted me, at least you could tell me how the kids are doing. And all sorts of things. So you have all of this pain that you can see him really struggling with. And then there's this letter that Mary writes him back. And she wrote it on April 11th, 1839, so it didn't have time to reach him while he was in the jail. But her answer to him, she says pretty early on in her letter, she says, okay, there's this thing that we need to address, and it's this concern that you've had about me abandoning you. And she says, I have something to say to you about that. And this is what she says. She says, I cannot bear the thought of you having any such suspicion. Surely you had not. If so, you are yet unacquainted with the principles of my heart. What, should I forsake a friend and a bosom friend in the time of adversity and affliction, when all the sympathy and affection I am capable of feeling is called for to soothe and comfort as far as possible under such circumstances as you are placed in? No, reason, religion, and honor, and every feeling of my heart forbid such a thought to enter there. And then she talks about how something must have possessed him, some sort of fear, something from the adversary must have taken over his thoughts to make him...
And I think it's really indicative of their experience of, you know, how they were feeling, how all of them were feeling. Like, Hiram's letters are so, as Millie said, he's so almost depressed, you know, just very low, and he feels these fears. And I think that is very indicative of how all of them felt.
Yeah. The other thing that I think is really there that really stood out to me in the letters is in Joseph's two letters that he wrote to the church. He wrote one in December, on December 16th, 1838, to the church, and he wrote another one in March. It was dated March 20th.
So the December one is early on.
Right. So there's quite a gap of time between them. And the difference in the tone of the two letters is really striking. And in the first one, he's angry. You can tell he is, and he has a right to be angry. He's had a lot of difficulties that he's dealing with, and he's in the pit of a dungeon, and he's writing, and he's angry. And in the second one, it's very tempered, and there are a couple of points of interest. I think, like, in the first one, for instance, he talks about a lot of the dissenters. He calls them by name. He compares them to people in the Bible that came to violent ends, like Haman and Korah and Dathan and Abiram, who were buried alive. And at one point, he compares W.W. Phelps to Job's friends in the Bible, who told him that he had sinned and that he had brought on all of his difficulties. And in the second letter, he's a lot more calm, and he talks a lot about how friendship, tokens of friendship, can heal all of these wounds between friends. And then he talks about, he records the Lord telling him, you're not yet as Job. So in the first letter, W.W. Phelps is Job's comforter, which would make him Job, right? And in the second one, he's not yet as Job. Things aren't quite as bad as...
That gives me a whole new insight to that reference, You're Not Yet His Job. I didn't know where that came from. That's interesting. I didn't know that about W.W. Phelps. That's interesting.
And really, it was the second letter written on the 20th of March in 1839 that Liberty Jail is really known for, because it's from that letter that we get sections 121, 122, and 123 from the Doctrine and Covenants. And these sections were all pulled from that letter. I mean, the whole letter itself is just a fabulous piece of writing, and there are numerous truths and insights into the prophet and really who he was that come from this letter. But, you know, these three sections were pulled as and canonized as inspired writings, as revelation given to the prophet Joseph. And Elder Neil Maxwell, in referring to these writings and this whole Liberty Jail experience, he said that in the midst of his adversity, meaning the prophets, there came one of the most sublime and significant revelations ever received by Joseph or any other prophet, that now numbered sections 121 and 122 of the Doctrine and Covenants. These revelations are so invested with rich truths that any focusing on one portion is apt, even unintentionally, to neglect another. And so these were seen as, you know, some of the greatest revelations ever received by a prophet of God.
You know, and it gives you a great insight. I love hearing things that show the human side of the prophets, and so on. His first letter where he's upset, and it shows this, he behaves like other humans would behave in a situation like that.
At the same time, you also see this huge growth that he went through while he was in the jail. You can see the humility and the charity that he that has increased in him for the people associated with the situation that he's found himself in. And I think that says a lot about him also, especially as a prophet. He that he took this really dismal, really awful experience and became a better person.
And it was a refining experience. I mean, Alvin R. Dyer, he published a book about the Missouri period, and where I believe it's called The Refiner's Fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, for the prophet personally and for the church, it really was a refiner's fire. I mean, they went into this horrible experience, you know, and dealt with it and languished in the Liberty Jail for months, but they emerged from it better people, stronger people, more faithful people. And Elder Maxwell, again, referring to the prophet, he said Joseph was more obedient after this. And, you know, he had learned obedience through this experience.
Well, it brings to mind B.H. Roberts' reference to the prison, Elder B.H. Roberts, but he was a great historian of the church, too, and he referred to it as the prison temple. One of you elaborate on that, the idea of this being a prison temple.
We're going to let Gary take care of it.
Really wanted this one.
As you mentioned, B.H. Roberts coined the phrase a prison temple. And he used this phrase. Let me back up. B.H. Roberts coined the term prison temple, and it was used specifically to describe Liberty Jail. And since that time, it has been used widely. I mean, the exhibits there, it's mentioned. Elder Maxwell, in one of his books, called But for a Small Moment, he refers to Liberty as the prison temple. And even as recently as last year, Elder Holland referred to it as a prison temple. And we kind of struggled with that concept because when we think of a temple, you know, we think of a beautiful, quiet, sacred, clean place. And the Liberty Jail was the farthest thing from that. But Elder Holland, in in this talk that he gave last year at a CES fireside called Lessons from Liberty Jail, he gives, I think, the reason why B.H. Roberts really saw this as a prison temple. And I would just like to quote from this talk that Elder Holland gave. And speaking of Liberty Jail, he said, "Certainly it lacked the purity, the beauty, the comfort, and the cleanliness of our true temples, our dedicated temples. The speech and behavior of the guards and criminals who came there was anything but temple-like. In fact, the restricting brutality and injustice of this experience at Liberty would make it seem the very antithesis of the liberating, merciful spirit of our temples and the ordinances that are performed in them. So in what sense could Liberty Jail be called a temple, or at least a kind of temple, in the development of Joseph Smith personally and in his role as a prophet?" Well, Elder Holland continues a little bit later in his talk, and he says that what we should really learn from this is when, and I'm quoting again, "when you have to, you can have sacred, revelatory, profoundly instructive experience with the Lord in any situation you are in. Indeed, let me say that even a little stronger. You can have sacred, revelatory, profoundly instructive experience with the Lord in the most miserable experiences of your life, in the worst settings, while enduring the most painful injustices, when facing the most insurmountable odds and opposition you have ever faced." And, you know, I look back in my own life and the times when I have felt closest to God or have really felt that I have been taught from God are the most miserable times in my lives. And, you know, that is, I think, when we're driven to our knees and we're humble enough to ask God for help, and he blesses us with these experiences. And going back to the prophet in Liberty Jail, you know, he had been there for almost 4 months. He had been in this miserable condition, in this hole where, you know, they didn't get, you know, good food to eat. It was a horrible place to try to sleep. And just, and then hearing of the condition of the saints as they were forced out of Missouri, just all this weighed on the prophet. And I think it was frustrating to him. Here he was, a leader, God's chosen prophet, to lead these people, and he was languishing in this horrible jail. Well, and in the letter on March 20th of 1839, you know, it's almost like he's finally kind of had enough. I mean, he's done everything that he can, and so he cries out, "O God, where art thou? And where is the pavilion that covereth thy hiding place?" And then he goes on, you know, saying, asking God, you know, "How long are these wrongs and unlawful oppressions going to accompany our people?" And he, you know, then and this is coming from section 121, and in verse 5, he says, "Let thine anger be kindled against our enemies, and in the fury of thine heart with the sword avenge us of our wrongs." So he's almost asking God to just come down and wipe out these people. And he's, you know, just kind of had enough. But then the Lord, being the Lord, he, in verse 7, he says, "My son, peace be unto thy soul. Thine adversity and thine affliction shall be but a small moment. And then, if thou endure it well, God shall exalt thee on high. Thou shalt triumph over all thy foes." And so the Lord, you know, reminds the prophet that, you know, the Lord is in charge. He's fully aware of the prophet and his surroundings. He's aware of his people and the sufferings that are taking place. But later in section 121, the Lord is kind of foreshadowing the blessings that will come not only to the prophet, but to the church as a whole for having gone through all these experiences. And He said that in verse 26, the Lord revealed that God shall give unto you knowledge by his Holy Spirit, yea, by the unspeakable gift of the Holy Ghost, that has not been revealed since the world was until now, which our forefathers have awaited with anxious expectation to be revealed in the last times, which their minds were pointed to by the angels as held in reserve for the fullness of their glory. So the Lord is going to bless the saints with this wonderful blessing that prophets for generations have waited for. And then in verse 28, he says, a time to come in which nothing shall be withheld. And then in 29, he says, all thrones and dominions, principalities and powers shall be revealed and set forth upon all those who have endured valiantly for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Well, we know that those blessings came about with the temple in Nauvoo. And, you know, as you read those words, you can think of the temple. They're similar things to what we hear to here in the temple. And so this refiner's fire that the prophet and the saints went through, you know, it really refined the church. I mean, the unfaithful, the people who really weren't supportive of the prophet, who really weren't members of the church. They were members of the church on a list. I mean, they weren't really the true and faithful that the Lord needed. So it was kind of like a weeding process where only the true and faithful who went through these and settled on the banks of the Mississippi River and Nauvoo and constructed the temple, you know, they were able to receive the blessings of the endowment and the temple and everything that's associated with that.
Well, in DNC 122, again, coming from the same letter that Joseph wrote from Liberty Jail, the Lord promises Joseph that all of these things will give the experience will be for thy good. And there are so many ways, this being one of them, that experience wound up being for the good of the church and for the people involved in it.
And even for us today, and I think this is one of the reasons why the Lord revealed this and it was placed into the Doctrine and Covenants, is as we go through our lives, you know, we're all going to face adversity and difficulties and probably nothing near what the prophet went to, but we're all going to face challenges. It's a part of life. And being, you know, who we are as, you know, humans and imperfect people, we sometimes can forget that, you know, the Lord does love us. He is aware of our plight and of our situations. But if we faithfully go through these experiences, you know, we'll come out better people for it. We'll come out stronger people as a result of it. And again, thinking back in my own life, you know, just recently my father-in-law passed away from a 3-year struggle with cancer. And at his funeral, I was asked to speak, and instantly I went to this section 122, and I thought back, you know, okay, how of everybody in my family, my wife's family, how are we stronger because of this experience we went through? And you know, we came together as a family. We're a much stronger family now. You know, we were able to serve my father-in-law and care for him and bless his life and be able to know him. And myself, I'm a better person because of the time I spent with him and got to know him. And even looking at my father-in-law having to go through that experience when he passed to the other side of the veil, he passed through being a stronger person, having gone through the miserable experience he went through. And I think if all of us look at our lives and the tough times that we've had in our lives, we can, you know, it's hard to see when we're going through them, but hindsight, we can look back and I think really say that, you know, the Lord is mindful of us. at times when we thought we were alone, he was with us more than we ever could imagine. And I think this is something that the prophet learned personally, that, you know, he was God's chosen prophet. And he emerged from Liberty Jail stronger, more faithful. He learned to be more compassionate. He learned to be more patient, and I think he really stepped from Liberty Jail with the confidence, knowing that he was God's chosen prophet. And there's one thing that I would like to read, and I'm quoting from Elder Maxwell. He says, "Earlier, Joseph had Oliver Cowdery and Sidney Rigdon to be not only his aides-de-camp, but also in measure as his spokesman. After the Liberty Jail experience, however, Joseph was clearly his own spokesman. From that time forward, we began to receive Joseph's stretching sermons involving some of the gospel's most powerful doctrines." And so I truly believe that Joseph emerged from Liberty Jail more confident in his calling as a prophet of God. I mean, he went from these horrible experiences in Missouri and within a short period of time built up Nauvoo. And it's a miraculous story of the accomplishment of the prophet and what the saints did under his direction in Nauvoo. And, you know, the building of the temple and the wonderful blessings that came out to the saints because of that.
And he only lived 5 more years after Liberty Jail.
Yeah.
And accomplished an incredible amount of...
That's correct. And, you know, it's in those 5.5 years that, you know, as Elder Maxwell stated, that's when we truly get, you know, the doctrinal sermons and the teachings of the prophet Joseph. And, you know, fortunately, many of his sermons and discourses have been preserved by great journal keepers at the time, and which in turn give us a better understanding of the gospel and I think a greater appreciation of the prophet Joseph and really the great man that he was and is.
We have been visiting today with Gary Boatwright Jr., Amy Neufer, and Melanie Hinton. You are listening to Legacy on the Mormon Channel. I'm Matt Henderson.